Abel with the curly hair and the weird dress is standing a few feet away. Her eyes dart between the words on the sign and the can in my hand, which rattles when I drop my arm. "This isn't what it looks like," I say.
Chapter 4. Ellery. Saturday, September 7th. How's everything going? I consider the text from my friend Lourdes. She's in California, but not at La Puente. I met her in 6th grade, which was 3 towns before we moved there. Or maybe 4. Unlike Ezra, who jumps easily into the social scene every time we switch schools, I hang on to my virtual best friend and keep the in-person stuff surface level. It's easier to move on that way. It requires fewer emo playlists anyway. Let's see. We've been here a week, and so far the highlight is yard work. Lourdes sends a few sad face emojis, then adds, "It'll pick up when school starts. Have you met any cute preppy New England guys yet?" "Just one, but not preppy. And possibly a vandal." "Do tell." I pause, not sure how to explain my run-in with the boy at Lacey Kilduff's fundraiser, when my phone buzzes with a call from a number with a California area code. I don't recognize it, but my heart leaps, and I fire off a quick text to Lourdes. "Hang on, getting a call about my luggage, I hope. I've been in Vermont a full week, and my suitcase is still missing. If it doesn't show up within the next 2 days, I'm going to have to start school in the clothes my grandmother bought at Echo Ridge's one and only clothing store. It's called Dalton's Emporium, and also sells kitchen goods and hardware, which should tell you everything you need to know about its fashion cred. No one who's older than 6 or younger than 60 should shop there, ever." "Hello?" "Ellery, hi!" I almost drop my phone, and when I don't answer, the voice doubles down on its cheerful urgency. "It's me!" "Yeah, I know." I lower myself stiffly onto my bed, gripping the phone in my suddenly sweaty palm. "How are you calling me?" Sadie's tone turns reproachful. "You don't sound very happy to hear from me." "It's just, I thought we were supposed to start talking next Thursday." Those were the rules of rehab, according to Nana. 15-minute Skype sessions once a week after 2 full weeks of treatment had been completed. Not random calls from an unknown number. "The rules here are ridiculous," Sadie says. I can practically hear the eye roll in her voice. "One of the aides is letting me use her phone. She's a Defender fan." The only speaking role Sadie ever had was in the first installment of what turned out to be a huge action series in the 90s, The Defender, about a down-on-his-luck soldier turned avenging cyborg. She played a sexy robot named Zeta Voltz, and even though she had only one line, "That does not compute," there are still fan websites dedicated to the character. "I'm dying to see you, love. Let's switch to FaceTime." I pause before hitting accept, because I'm not ready for this. At all. But what am I going to do? Hang up on my mother? Within seconds, Sadie's face fills the screen, bright with anticipation. She looks the same as ever. Nothing like me except for the hair. Sadie's eyes are bright blue, while mine are so dark they almost look black. She's sweet-faced with soft, open features, and I'm all angles and straight lines. There's only one other trait we share, and when I see the dimple in her right cheek flash with a smile, I force myself to mirror it back. "There you are," she crows. Then a frown creases her forehead. "What's going on with your hair?" My chest constricts. "Is that seriously the first thing you have to say to me?" I haven't talked to Sadie since she checked into Hamilton House, the pricey rehab center Nana's paying for. Considering she demolished an entire storefront, Sadie lucked out. She didn't hurt herself or anyone else, and she wound up in front of a judge who believes in treatment instead of jail time. But she's never been particularly grateful. Everyone and everything else is at fault. The doctor who gave her too strong a prescription, bad lighting on the street, our car's ancient brakes. It didn't fully hit me until just now, sitting in a bedroom that belongs to a grandmother I barely know, listening to Sadie criticize my hair through a phone that someone could probably get fired for giving her. How infuriating it all is. Oh, Elle, of course not. I'm just teasing. You look beautiful. How are you? How am I supposed to answer that? I'm fine. What happened in your first week? Tell me everything. I could refuse to play along, I guess. But as my eye catches the photo of Sadie and her sister on my bookcase, I already feel myself wanting to please her. To smooth things over and make her smile. I've been doing it my entire life. It's impossible to stop now. Things are just as weird as you've always said. I've already been questioned twice by the police. Her eyes pop. What? I tell her about the hit and run and the graffiti at Lacey's fundraiser 3 days ago. Declan Kelly's brother wrote that? Sadie asks, looking outraged. He said he just found the paint canister. She snorts. Likely story. I don't know, he looked pretty shocked when I saw him. God, poor Melanie and Dan. That's the last thing they need. The police officer I talked to at the fundraiser said he knew you. Officer McNulty? I forget his first name. Sadie grins. Chad McNulty! Yeah, we dated sophomore year. God, you're going to meet all my exes, aren't you? Was Vance Puckett there, by any chance? He used to be gorgeous. I shake my head. Ben Coates? Peter Nilsson? None of those names are familiar, except the last one. I met him at the fundraiser, right after his stepson and I reported the sign vandalism. You dated that guy? I ask. Doesn't he own, like, half the town? I guess so. Cute, but kind of a tight ass. We went out twice when I was a senior, but he was in college then, and we didn't really click. He's Malcolm's stepfather now, I tell her. Sadie's face scrunches in confusion. Who? Malcolm Kelly. Declan Kelly's brother? The one with the spray paint? Good Lord, Sadie mutters. I cannot keep up with that place. Some of the tenseness that's been keeping me rigid ebbs away, and I laugh as I settle back against my pillow. Sadie's superpower is making you feel as though everything's going to be fine, even when it's mostly disastrous. Officer McNulty said his son's in our class. I tell her. I guess he was at the fundraiser, but I didn't meet him. Ugh, we're all so old now. Did you talk to him about the hit and run too? No, that officer was really young. Ryan Rodriguez? I don't expect Sadie to recognize the name, but an odd expression flits across her face. What? Do you know him? I ask. No, how would I? Sadie asks, a little too quickly. When she catches my dubious squint, she adds, Well, it's just... Now, don't go making too much of this, Ellery, because I know the way you think. But he fell apart at Lacey's funeral. Way more than her boyfriend did. It caught my attention, so I remembered it. That's all. Fell apart how? Sadie heaves a theatrical sigh. I knew you'd ask that. You brought it up. Oh, just, you know, he cried a lot, almost collapsed. His friends had to carry him out of the church. And I said to Melanie, wow, they must have been really close. But she said they barely knew one another. Sadie lifts a shoulder in a half shrug. He probably had a crush, that's all. Lacey was a beauty. What's that? She glances off to one side, and I hear the murmur of another voice. Oh, okay. Sorry, Elle, but I have to go. Tell Ezra I'll call him soon, okay? I love you, and... She pauses, something like regret crossing her face for the first time. And I'm glad you're meeting people. No apology. Saying she's sorry would mean acknowledging that something's wrong, and even when she's calling me cross-country from rehab on a contraband phone, Sadie can't do it. I don't answer, and she adds, I hope you're doing something fun for your Saturday afternoon. I'm not sure if fun is the right word, but it's something I've been planning since I learned I was going to Echo Ridge. Fright Farm opens for the season today, and I'm going. Sadie shakes her head with exasperated fondness. Of course you are, she says, and blows me a kiss before she disconnects. Hours later, Ezra and I are walking through the woods behind Nana's house toward Fright Farm, leaves crunching beneath our feet. I'm wearing some of my new Dalton's clothes, which Ezra has been snickering at since we left the house.
I mean,
he says as we step over a fallen branch. What would you even call those? Leisure pants? Shut up, I grumble. The pants, which are some kind of synthetic stretchy material, were the most inoffensive piece of clothing I could find. At least they're black and sort of fitted. My gray and white checked t-shirt is short and boxy and has such a high neck that it's almost choking me. I'm pretty sure I've never looked worse. First Sadie with the hair, now you with the clothes. Ezra's smile is bright and hopeful.
She looked good, though?
He asks. He and Sadie are so similar sometimes, so blissfully optimistic, that it's impossible to say what you really think around them. When I used to try, Sadie would sigh and say, don't be such an Eeyore, Ellery. Once, only once, she had added under her breath, you're just like Sarah. Then pretended not to hear me when I asked her to repeat what she had said. She looked great, I tell Ezra. We hear noise from the park before we see it. Once we emerge from the woods, it's impossible to miss. The entrance looms across the road in the shape of a huge, monstrous head with glowing green eyes and a mouth wide open in a scream that serves as the door. It looks exactly like it did in pictures from the news coverage about Lacey's murder, except for the arched sign that reads, Fright Farm, in spiky red letters. Ezra shades his eyes against the sun.
I'm just gonna say it. Fright Farm is a crap name. Murderland was better.
Agreed, I say. There's a road running between the woods and the Fright Farm entrance, and we wait for a few cars to pass before crossing it. A tall black spire fence circles the park, enclosing clusters of tents and rides. Fright Farm opened less than an hour ago, but it's already packed. Screams fill the air as a salt and pepper shaker ride flips back and forth. When we get closer to the entrance, I see that the face is covered with mottled and red-specked grayish paint, so it looks like a decaying corpse. There's a row of four booths directly inside, with one cashier to a booth, and at least two dozen people waiting. Ezra and I get in line, but I break away after a few minutes to check out the information board and grab a bunch of papers stacked up beneath it. Maps, I tell Ezra. I hand him one, plus another sheet of paper. And job applications. His brow furrows.
You want to work here?
We're broke, remember? And where else would we work? I don't think there's any place in walking distance. Neither of us have our driver's license, and I can tell already Nana's not the chauffeuring type. Ezra shrugs. All right, hand it over. I fish a couple of pins out of my messenger bag, and we almost complete the applications before it's our turn to buy tickets. I fold Ezra's and mine together and stuff them both in the front pocket of my bag as we leave the booths. We can drop them off before we go home.
Where should we go first? Ezra asks.
I unfold my map and study it. It looks like we're in the kids section right now, I report. Dark Matters is to the left. That's an evil science laboratory. Bloody Big Top to the right. Probably self-explanatory. And the House of Horrors is straight ahead. That doesn't open till 7, though. Ezra leans over my shoulder and lowers his voice.
Where did Lacey die?
I point to a tiny picture of a Ferris wheel. Under there. Well, that's where they found her body, anyway. Police thought she was probably meeting someone. Echo Ridge kids used to sneak into the park after hours all the time, I guess. It didn't have any security cameras back then. We both glance up at the nearest building, where a red light blinks from one corner. Does now, obviously.
Do you want to start there? Ezra asks.
My throat gets dry. A group of masked kids dressed in black swoops past us, one of them knocking into my shoulder so hard that I stumble. Maybe we should check out the games, I say, refolding the map. It was a lot easier to take ghoulish pleasure at visiting a crime scene before I met the victim's family. We walk past snack stands and carnival games, pausing to watch a boy our age sink enough baskets in a row to win a stuffed black cat for his girlfriend. The next station has the kind of shooting gallery game where two players each try to knock over 12 targets in a box. A guy wearing a ratty hunting jacket who looks like he's 40 or so pumps his fist in the air and lets out a loud guffaw.
Beat ya,
he says, punching the shoulder of the kid next to him. The man stumbles a little with the movement, and the boy recoils and backs away. Maybe you should give someone else a turn. The girl behind the counter is about my age and pretty, with a long brown ponytail that she winds anxiously around her fingers. The man in the hunting jacket waves the toy gun he's holding.
Plenty of room next to me. Anybody can play if they're not too chicken.
His voice is loud and he's slurring his words. The girl crosses her arms as if she's steeling herself to sound tough. There are lots of other games you could play.
You're just mad because nobody can beat me. Tell you what, if any of these losers could knock down more than me, I'll bow out. Who wants to try?
He turns toward the small crowd gathering around the stand, revealing a lean, scruffy face. Ezra nudges me.
How can you resist? He asks under his breath.
I hesitate, waiting to see if someone older or bigger might help out. But when nobody does, I step forward. I will. I meet the girl's eyes, which are hazel, heavily mascaraed, and shadowed with dark circles. She looks like she hasn't slept in a week. The guy blinks at me a few times, then bends at the waist in an exaggerated bow. The movement almost topples him, but he rights himself.
Well, hello, madam. Challenge accepted. I'll even pay for you.
He fishes 2 crumpled dollars out of his pocket and hands them to the girl. She takes them gingerly and drops them into a box in front of her as if they were on fire.
Never let it be said that Vance Puckett isn't a gentleman.
Vance Puckett? I burst out before I can stop myself.
This is Sadie's ex?
The gorgeous one? Either her standards were a lot lower in Echo Ridge, or he peaked in high school. His bloodshot eyes narrow, but without a spark of recognition. Not surprising. With my hair pulled back, there's nothing Sadie-like about me.
Do I know you?
No. It's just... that's a good name, I say limply. The ponytailed girl presses a button to reset the targets. I move to the second station as Vance raises the gun and sets his sights.
Champions first, he says loudly,
and starts firing off shots in quick succession. Even though he's clearly drunk, he manages to knock over 10 of the 12 targets. He raises the gun when he's finished and kisses the barrel, causing the girl to grimace.
Still got it, Vance says, making a sweeping gesture toward me. Your move, m'lady.
I raise the gun in front of me. I happen to possess what Ezra calls freakishly good aim, despite having zero athletic talent in any other capacity. My hands are slick with sweat as I close one eye. Don't overthink it, I remind myself. Just point and shoot. I press the trigger and miss the first target, but not by much. Vance snickers beside me. I adjust my aim and hit the second. The crowd behind me starts murmuring when I've lowered the rest of the targets in the top row, and by the time I've hit 9, they're clapping. The applause spikes at number 10 and turns into whoops and cheers when I knock over the last one and finish with 11 down. Ezra raises both arms in the air like I just scored a touchdown. Vance stares at me, slack-jawed.
You're a goddamn ringer. Move along, Vance, someone calls. There's a new sheriff in town.
The crowd laughs, and Vance scowls. For a few beats, I think he won't budge. Then he flings his gun on the counter with a snort.
Game's fixed anyway,
he mutters, stepping back and shoving his way through the crowd. The girl turns toward me with a tired but grateful smile. Thanks. He's been here for almost half an hour, freaking everyone out. I thought he was going to start firing into the crowd any minute now. They're only pellets, but still. She reaches under the counter and pulls out a handy wipe, swiping it thoroughly across Vance's gun. I owe you one. Do you guys want free wristbands to the House of Horrors? I almost say yes, but pull out my and Ezra's job applications instead. Actually, would you mind putting a good word in for us with your boss, or whoever does the hiring around here? The girl tugs on her ponytail instead of taking the papers from me. Thing is, they only hire kids from Echo Ridge. We are, I say brightly. We just moved here. She blinks at us. You did? Are you? Oh. I can almost see the puzzle pieces locked together in her mind as she glances between Ezra and me. You must be the Corcoran twins. It's the same reaction we've been getting all week. Like all of a sudden she knows everything about us. After spending our lives in the orbit of a city where everyone's fighting for recognition, it's weird to be so effortlessly visible. I'm not sure I like it, but I can't argue with the results when she extends her hand toward the applications with a beckoning motion. I'm Brooke Bennett. We'll be in the same class next week. Let me see what I can do.
Chapter 5. Malcolm. Sunday, September 8th. You have 4 kinds of sparkling water, Mia reports from the depths of our refrigerator. Not flavors, brands. Perrier, San Pellegrino, LaCroix, and Polar. The last one's a little down market, so I'm guessing it's a nod to your humble roots. Want one? I want a Coke, I say without much hope. The Nilsson's housekeeper, who does all the grocery shopping, isn't a fan of refined sugar. It's the Sunday before school starts, and Mia and I are the only ones here. Mom and Peter left for a drive after lunch, and Katrin and her friends are out back to school shopping. I'm afraid that's not an option, Mia says, pulling out two bottles of lemon polar seltzer and handing one to me. This refrigerator contains only clear beverages. At least it's consistent. I set my bottle down on the kitchen island next to a stack of the college brochures that have started to arrive for Katrin on a daily basis. Brown, Amherst, Georgetown, Cornell. They seem like a stretch for her GPA, but Peter likes people to aim high. Mia unscrews the cap from her bottle and takes a long swig, making a face. Ew, this tastes like cleaning solution. We could go to your house, you know. Mia shakes her head so violently that her red-tipped dark hair flies in her face. No, thank you. Tensions are high in the Kwan household, my friend. The return of Daisy has everyone shook. I thought Daisy's coming home was temporary. So did we all, Mia says in her narrator voice. And yet, she remains. Mia and I are friends, partly because a long time ago, Declan and her sister Daisy were. Lacey Kilduff and Daisy Kwan had been best friends since kindergarten, so once Declan and Lacey started dating, I saw almost as much of Daisy as I did of Lacey. Daisy was my first crush, the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen in real life. I could never figure out what Declan saw in Lacey when Daisy was right there. Meanwhile, Mia was in love with both Lacey and Declan. We were a couple of awkward preteens trailing around after our golden siblings and their friends, lapping up whatever scraps of attention they'd throw our way. And then it all imploded. Lacey died. Declan left, suspected and disgraced. Daisy went to Princeton just like she was supposed to, graduated with honors, and got a great job at a consulting firm in Boston. Then, barely a month after she started, she abruptly quit and moved back home with her parents. Nobody knows why. Not even Mia. A key jingles in the lock, and loud giggles erupt in the foyer. Katrin comes sweeping into the kitchen with her friends Brooke and Viv, all three of them weighed down by brightly colored shopping bags. Hey, she says. She swings her bags onto the kitchen island, almost knocking over Mia's bottle. Do not go to the Bellevue Mall today. It's a zoo. Everybody's buying their homecoming dresses already. She sighs heavily, like she wasn't doing the exact same thing. We all got a welcome back email from the principal last night, including a link to a new school app that lets you view your schedule and sign up for stuff online. The homecoming ballot was already posted, where, theoretically, you can vote anyone from our class onto the court. But in reality, everybody knows four of the six spots are already taken by Katrin, Theo, Brooke, and Kyle. Wasn't planning on it, Mia says dryly. Viv smirks at her. Well, they don't have a hot topic, so... Katrin and Brooke giggle, although Brooke looks a little guilty while she does it. There's a lot about my and Katrin's lives that don't blend well, and our friends top the list. Brooke's all right, I guess, but Viv's the third wheel in their friend trio, and the insecurity makes her bitchy. Or maybe that's just how she is. Mia leans forward and rests her middle finger on her chin, but before she can speak, I grab a bouquet of cellophane-wrapped flowers from the island. We should go before it starts raining, I say. Or hailing. Katrin waggles her brows at the flowers. Who are those for? Mr. Bowman, I say, and her teasing grin drops. Brooke makes a strangled sound, her eyes filling with tears. Even Viv shuts up. Katrin sighs and leans against the counter. School's not going to be the same without him, she says. Mia hops off her stool. Sucks how people in this town keep getting away with murder, doesn't it? Viv snorts, pushing a strand of red hair behind one ear. A hit and run is an accident? Not in my book, Mia says. The hitting part, maybe, not the running. Mr. Bowman might still be alive if whoever did it stopped to call for help. Katrin puts an arm around Brooke, who started to cry, silently. It's been like that all week whenever I run into people from school. They're fine one minute and sobbing the next, which does kind of bring back memories of Lacey's death, minus all the news cameras. How are you getting to the cemetery? Katrin asks me. Mom's car, I say. I blocked her in. Just take mine, she says, reaching into her bag for the keys. Fine by me. Katrin has a BMW X6, which is fun to drive. She doesn't offer it up often, but I jump at the chance when she does. I grab the keys and make a hasty exit before she can change her mind. How can you stand living with her? Mia grumbles as we walk out the front door. Then she turns and walks backward, gazing up at the Nilsons' enormous house. I guess the perks aren't bad, are they? I open the X6's door and slide into the car's buttery leather interior. Sometimes I still can't believe this is my life. Could be worse, I say. It's a quick trip to Echo Ridge Cemetery, and Mia spends most of it flipping rapidly through all of Katrin's pre-programmed radio stations. Nope. 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 She keeps muttering, right up until we pull through the wrought iron gates. Echo Ridge has one of those historic cemeteries with graves that date back to the 1600s. The trees surrounding it are ancient and so huge that their branches act like a canopy above us. Tall, twisting bushes line gravel paths, and the whole space is enclosed within stone walls. The gravestones are all shapes and sizes, tiny stumps barely visible in the grass, tall slabs with names carved across the front in block letters, a few statues of angels or children. Mr. Bowman's grave is in the newer section. We spot it right away. The grass in front is covered with flowers, stuffed animals, and notes. The simple gray stone is carved with his name, the years of his life, and an inscription. Tell me, and I forget. Teach me, and I may remember. Involve me, and I learn. I unwrap our bouquet and silently add it to the pile. I thought there'd be something I'd want to say when I got here, but my throat closes as a wave of nausea hits me. Mom and I were still visiting family in New Hampshire when Mr. Bowman died, so we missed his funeral. Part of me was sorry, but another part was relieved. I haven't been to a funeral since I went to Lacey's 5 years ago. She was buried in her homecoming dress, and all her friends wore theirs to her funeral, splashes of bright colors in the sea of black. It was hot for October, and I remember sweating in my itchy suit beside my father. The stares and whispers about Declan had already started. My brother stood apart from us, still as a statue, while my father pulled at the collar of his shirt like the scrutiny was choking him. My parents lasted about 6 months after Lacey was killed. Things weren't great before then. On the surface, their arguments were always about money, utility bills and car repairs and the second job Mom thought Dad should get when they cut his hours at the warehouse. But really, it was about the fact that at some point over the years, they'd stopped liking one another. They never yelled, just walked around with so much simmering resentment that it spread through the entire house like poisonous gas. At first, I was glad when he left. Then, when he moved in with a woman half his age and kept forgetting to send support checks, I got angry. But I couldn't show it, because angry had become something people said about Declan in hushed, accusing tones. Mia's wobbly voice brings me back into the present. It sucks that you're gone, Mr. Bowman. Thanks for always being so nice and never comparing me to Daisy, unlike every other teacher in the history of the world. Thanks for making science almost interesting. I hope karma smacks whoever did this in the ass, and they get exactly what they deserve. My eyes sting. I blink and look away, catching an unexpected glimpse of red in the distance. I blink again, then squint. What's that? Mia shades her eyes and follows my gaze. What's what? It's impossible to tell from where we're standing. We start picking our way across the grass, through a section of squat colonial-era graves carved with winged skulls. Here lieth the body of Mrs. Samuel White, reads the last one we pass. Mia, momentarily distracted, aims a pretend kick at the stone. She had her own name, asshole, she says. Then we're finally close enough to make out what caught our eye back at Mr. Bowman's grave and stop in our tracks. This time, it's not just graffiti. Three dolls hang from the top of a mausoleum, nooses around their necks. They're all wearing crowns and long, glittering dresses drenched in red paint. And just like at the cultural center, red letters drip like blood across the white stone beneath them. I'm back. Pick your queen, Echo Ridge. Happy homecoming. A garish red spattered corsage decorates a grave next to the mausoleum, and my stomach twists when I recognize this section of the cemetery. I stood almost exactly where I'm standing now when Lacey was buried. Mia chokes out a furious gasp as she makes the same connection and lunges forward like she's about to sweep the bloody-looking corsage off the top of Lacey's grave. I catch her arm before she can. Don't. We shouldn't touch anything. And then my disgust takes a brief back seat to another unwelcome thought. Shit. I have to be the one to report this again. I got lucky last week, sort of. The new girl, Ellery, believed me enough that when we went inside to tell an adult, she didn't mention she'd found me holding the can. But the whispers started buzzing through the cultural center anyway, and they've been following me around ever since. Twice in 1 week isn't great. Not in line with the keep your head down till you can get out strategy I've been working on ever since Declan left town. Maybe somebody else already has, and the police just haven't gotten here yet, Mia says, looking around. It's the middle of the day. People are in and out of here all the time. You'd think we'd have heard, though. Echo Ridge gossip channels are fast and foolproof. Even Mia and I are in the loop now that Katrin has my cell number. Mia bites her lip. We could take off and let somebody else make the call. Except, we told Katrin we were coming here, didn't we? So that won't work. It'd actually look worse if you didn't say something. Plus, it's just mega creepy. She digs the toe of her Doc Marten into the thick, bright green grass. I mean, do you think this is a warning or something? Like what happened to Lacey is going to happen again? Seems like the impression they're going for. I keep my voice casual while my brain spins, trying to make sense of what's in front of us. Mia pulls out her phone and starts taking pictures, circling the mausoleum so she can capture every angle. She's nearly done when a loud rustling noise makes us both jump. My heart thuds against my chest until a familiar figure bursts through a pair of bushes near the back of the cemetery. It's Vance Puckett. He lives behind the cemetery and probably cuts through here every day on his way to wherever he goes. I'd say the liquor store, but it's not open on Sunday. Vance starts weaving down the path toward the main entrance. He's only a few feet away when he finally notices us, flicking a bored glance our way that turns into a startled double take when he sees the mausoleum. He stops so short that he almost falls over. What the hell? Vance Puckett is the only person in Echo Ridge who's had a worse post-high school descent than my brother. He used to run a contracting business until he got sued over faulty wiring in a house that burned down in Salisbury. It's been one long slide into the bottom of a whiskey bottle ever since. There were a rash of petty break-ins in the Nilsons neighborhood right around the same time that Vance installed a satellite dish on Peter's roof, so everyone assumes he's found a new strategy for paying his bills. He's never been caught at anything, though. We just found this, I say. I don't know why I feel the need to explain myself to Vance Puckett, but here we are. He shuffles closer, his hands jammed into the pockets of his olive-green hunting jacket, and circles the mausoleum, letting out a low whistle when he finishes his examination. He smells faintly of booze, like always. "Pretty girls make graves," he says finally. "You know that song?" "Huh?" I ask, but Mia replies, "The Smiths." You can't stump her on anything music-related. Vance nods. "Fits this town, doesn't it? Echo Ridge keeps losing its homecoming queens. Or their sisters." His eyes roam across the three dolls. "Somebody got creative."
"It's not creative," Mia says coldly. "It's horrible."
"Never said it wasn't."
Vance sniffs loudly and makes a shooing motion with one hand.
"Why are you still here? Run along and tell the powers that be."
I don't like getting ordered around by Vance Puckett, but I don't want to stay here either. We were just about to. I start toward Katrin's car with Mia at my side, but Vance's sharp,
"Hey!"
makes us turn. He points toward me with an unsteady finger.
"You might want to tell that sister of yours to lie low for a change. Doesn't seem like a great year to be homecoming queen, does it?"
Chapter 6. Ellery. Monday, September 9th.
"It's like children of the corn around here," Ezra mutters, scanning the hallway. He's not wrong. We've been here only 15 minutes, but there are already more blonde-haired, blue-eyed people than I've ever seen gathered in one place. Even the building Echo Ridge High is housed in has a certain Puritan charm. It's old, with wide pine floors, high-arched windows, and dramatic sloped ceilings. We're heading from the guidance counselor's office to our new homeroom, and we might as well be leading a parade for all the stares we're getting. At least I'm in my airplane wardrobe, washed last night in preparation for the first day of school, instead of a Dalton special. We pass a bulletin board covered with colorful flyers, and Ezra pauses.
"It's not too late to join the 4-H club," he tells me.
"What's that?" He peers closer.
"Agriculture, I think. There seem to be cows involved."
"No thanks." He sighs, running his eyes over the rest of the board. "Something tells me they don't have a particularly active LGBTQ straight alliance here. I wonder if there's even another out kid." Normally I'd say there must be, but Echo Ridge is pretty small. There are less than 100 kids in our grade, and only a few hundred total in the school. We turn from the board as a cute Asian girl in a Strokes t-shirt and stacked-heeled Doc Martens passes by, her hair buzzed short on one side and streaked red on the other.
"Hey, Mia, you forgot to cut the other half,"
a boy calls out, making the two football-jacketed boys on either side of him snicker. The girl lifts her middle finger and shoves it in their faces without breaking stride. Ezra gazes after her with rapt attention.
"Hello, new friend."
The crowd in front of us parts suddenly as three girls stride down the hallway in almost perfect lockstep. One blonde, one brunette, and one redhead.
They're so obviously somebodies at Echo Ridge High that it takes me a second to realize that one of them is Brooke Bennett from the Fright Farm shooting range. She stops short when she sees us and offers a tentative smile.
Oh, hi. Did Murph ever call you?
Yeah, he did, I say. We have interviews this weekend. Thanks a lot. The blonde girl steps forward with the air of someone who's used to taking charge. She's wearing a sexy preppy outfit, collared shirt under a tight sweater, plaid miniskirt, and high-heeled booties.
Hi, you're the Corcoran twins, aren't you?
Ezra and I nod. We've gotten used to our sudden notoriety. Yesterday, while I was grocery shopping with Nana, a cashier I'd never seen before said,
"Hello, Nora. And Ellery?" as we were checking out.
Then she asked me questions about California the entire time she was bagging our groceries. Now, the blonde girl tilts her head at us.
"We've heard all about you."
She stops there, but the tone of her voice says, "And when I say all, I mean the one-night-stand father, the failed acting career, the jewelry store accident, the rehab, all of it." It's kind of impressive how much subtext she manages to pack into one tiny word.
"I'm Katrin Nilsson. I guess you've met Brooke, and this is Viv."
She points to the red-haired girl on her left. I should have known. I've heard the Nilsson name constantly since I got to Echo Ridge, and this girl has town royalty written all over her. She's not as pretty as Brooke, but somehow she's much more striking, with crystal blue eyes that remind me of a Siamese cat's. We all murmur hellos, and it feels like some sort of uncomfortable audition, probably because of the assessing look Katrin keeps giving Ezra and me, as though she's weighing whether we're worth her continued time and attention. Most of the hallway is only pretending to be busy with their lockers while they wait for her verdict. Then the bell rings, and she smiles.
"Come find us at lunch. We sit at the back table next to the biggest window."
She turns away without waiting for an answer, blonde hair sweeping across her shoulders. Ezra watches them leave with a bemused expression, then turns to me. "I have a really strong feeling that on Wednesdays they wear pink." Ezra and I have most of the same classes that morning, except for right before lunch, when I head to AP Calculus and Ezra goes to Geometry. Math isn't his strong suit, so I end up going to the cafeteria on my own. I make my way through the food line, assuming that he'll join me at any minute, but when I exit with a full tray, he's still nowhere in sight. I hesitate in front of the rows of rectangular tables, searching the sea of unfamiliar faces, when my name rings out in a clear, commanding voice.
"Ellery!"
I look up and spot Katrin with her arm in the air. Her hand makes a beckoning motion. I'm being summoned. It feels as though the entire room is watching me make my way to the back of the cafeteria, probably because they are. There's a giant poster on the wall beside Katrin's window table, which I can read when I'm less than halfway there. "Save the date. Homecoming is October 5th. Vote now for your king and queen." When I reach Katrin and her friends, the red-headed girl, Viv, shifts to make room on the bench. I put my tray down and slide in next to her, across from Katrin.
"Hi,"
Katrin says, her blue cat's eyes scanning me up and down. If I have to dress in clothes from Dalton's tomorrow, she's definitely going to notice.
"Where's your brother?"
"I seem to have misplaced him," I say, "but he always turns up eventually."
"I'll keep an eye out for him," Katrin says.
She digs one pale pink nail into an orange and tears off a chunk of the peel, adding,
"So, we're all super curious about you guys. We haven't had a new kid since..."
She scrunches her face.
"I don't know, 7th grade maybe?"
Viv straightens her shoulders. She's small and sharp-featured,
wearing bright red lipstick that goes surprisingly well with her hair. Yes, that was me.
Was it? Oh, right. Such a happy day.
Katrin smiles distractedly, still focused on me. But moving in middle school is one thing. Senior year is rough, especially when everything is so new.
How do you like living with your grandmother?
At least she didn't ask, like the grocery store cashier yesterday, if I had left a Hollywood hottie behind. The answer to that is no, by the way. I haven't had a date in 8 months. Not that I'm counting.
It's all right, I tell Katrin, sliding my eyes toward Brooke. Other than a muted hello when I sat down, she's been totally silent.
A little quiet, though. What do you guys do around here for fun?
I'm hoping to draw Brooke into the conversation, but it's Katrin who answers.
Well, we're cheerleaders, she says, waving a hand between her and Brooke. That takes up a lot of time in the fall, and our boyfriends play football. Her eyes drift a few tables away, where a blonde boy is setting down his tray. The entire table is a sea of purple and white athletic jackets. The boy catches her eye and winks, and Katrin blows him a kiss.
That's my boyfriend, Theo. He and Brooke's boyfriend, Kyle, are co-captains of the team.
Of course they are. She doesn't mention a boyfriend for Viv. I feel a small surge of solidarity.
Single girls unite.
But when I flash a smile at Viv, she meets it with a cool stare. I get the feeling, suddenly, that I have stumbled onto territory she'd rather not share.
That sounds fun, I say limply. I've never been part of the football and cheerleading crowd, although I appreciate the athleticism of both.
Viv narrows her eyes.
Echo Ridge might not be Hollywood, but it's not boring.
I don't bother correcting Viv that La Puente is 25 miles outside Hollywood. Everyone in Echo Ridge just assumes we lived in the middle of a movie set, and nothing I say will convince them otherwise. Besides, that's not our main issue right now.
I didn't say it was, I protest.
I mean, I can tell already there's a lot going on around here.
Viv looks unconvinced, but it's Brooke who finally speaks up.
None of it good, she says flatly. Her eyes are shiny as she turns toward me, and she looks like she's in desperate need of a full night's sleep.
Your grandmother found Mr. Bowman, didn't she?
I nod, and tears begin to spill down her pale cheeks. Katrin swallows a piece of orange and pats Brooke's arm.
You have to stop talking about it, Brooke. You keep getting worked up.
Viv heaves a dramatic sigh. It's been an awful week. First Mr. Bowman, then all that vandalism cropping up around town. Her tone is concerned, but her eyes are almost eager as she adds.
It's going to be our first feature of the year for the school paper. A summary of what's been going on all week, juxtaposed with this year's seniors, talking about where they were 5 years ago. It's the kind of story that might even get picked up by the local news.
She looks at me with slightly more warmth.
I should interview you. You found the graffiti at the cultural center, didn't you? You and Malcolm.
Yeah, I say. It was awful, but not nearly as awful as the cemetery. That made me sick when I heard about it, especially when I tried to imagine how the Kilduffs must feel.
The whole thing is horrible, Viv agrees, turning toward Katrin and Brooke. I hope nothing bad happens when you guys are announced next Thursday.
Announced? I ask.
They're going to announce the homecoming court at assembly next Thursday morning, Viv explains, gesturing toward the homecoming poster over Brooke's shoulder.
Everyone's voting between now and then. Did you download the Echo Ridge High app? Homecoming votes are on the main menu.
I shake my head.
No, not yet.
Viv makes a tisking noise.
Better hurry.
Voting closes next Wednesday, although most of the court is already a done deal. Katrin and Brooke are total shoo-ins.
You might get nominated too, Viv, Katrin says graciously. Even though I just met her, I can tell she doesn't actually believe there's a chance in hell of that happening. Viv shudders delicately. No, thank you. I don't want to be on the radar of some murderous creep who's decided to strike again.
Do you really think that's what this is about? I ask, curious.
Viv nods, and I lean forward eagerly. I've been thinking about the vandalism almost non-stop for the past couple of days, and I'm dying to share theories, even with Viv. Interesting. Maybe. I mean, it's definitely what the person who's doing it wants us to think, and that's disturbing on its own, but I keep wondering, even if you were brazen enough to get away with murder and then brag about doing it again 5 years later, the MOs are completely different. Katrin's face is a total blank.
M.O.? She asks.
Modus operandi, I say, warming to the topic. It's one where I'm perfectly confident. You know, the methods somebody uses to commit a crime? Lacey was strangled. That's a very personal and violent way to kill someone, and not likely to be premeditated. But these threats are public, and they require planning. Plus, they're much less, well, direct. To me, it feels more like a copycat, which isn't to say that person isn't dangerous, but maybe they're dangerous in a different way. There's a moment of silence at the table, until Katrin says, "Huh," and bites into an orange slice. She chews carefully, her eyes fixed on a spot somewhere over my shoulder.
There it is. I think. She just mentally dismissed me from the popular crowd. That didn't take long. If Ezra's told me once, he's told me 100 times. Nobody wants to hear your murder theories, Ellery. Too bad he bailed on me for lunch.
Then a new expression crosses Katrin's face, one that's sort of irritated and indulgent at the same time.
You're going to get kicked out of school one day for wearing that shirt, she calls to someone.
I turn to see Malcolm Kelly in a faded gray t-shirt with KCUF written across the front in block letters.
Hasn't happened yet, he replies.
In the bright fluorescent lights of the Echo Ridge High cafeteria, I get a much better look at him than I did at the cultural center. He's wearing a backward baseball cap over unruly brown hair, framing an angular face and wide-set eyes. They meet mine and flicker with recognition. He waves, and the movement jars his tray enough that he almost drops the whole thing. It's totally awkward and also weirdly kind of cute.
I'm sorry, Viv says as Malcolm turns away in the least apologetic tone I've ever heard.
But I find it super sketch that the first person to see both threats is Declan Kelly's weirdo brother. She shakes her head emphatically.
Uh-uh. Something's off there.
Oh, Viv, Katrin sighs, like they've had some variation on this conversation at least 12 times before.
Malcolm's all right. Kind of nerdy, but all right.
I don't think he's a nerd. Brooke's been quiet for so long that her sudden pronouncement startles everyone. Maybe he used to be, but he's gotten cute lately. Not as cute as Declan, but still.
Then she drops her head again and starts playing listlessly with her spoon, as if contributing to the conversation sapped whatever small reserves of energy she had.
Katrin gives her a speculative look.
Didn't realize you'd noticed, Brooke.
My head swivels, looking for Malcolm, and I spot him sitting with that girl Mia from the hallway, and my brother.
I'm not surprised. Ezra has a knack for inserting himself into whatever social group he's decided to join. At least I'll have another lunch option when I don't get invited back to Katrin's table.
Viv snorts.
Cute my ass, she says flatly.
Declan should be in jail.
You think he killed Lacey Kilduff?
I ask, and she nods. Katrin cocks her head, confused.
But weren't you just saying that whoever killed Lacey is leaving those threats around town? She asks. Declan lives in another state. Viv leans an elbow on the table, staring at her friend, eyes wide. You live with the Kellys and you seriously don't know?